Mr. Chairman, and friends. I think we all realize that in the course of the last few decades, quite a number of changes have taken place in different parts of the world. One might even say all over the world, but particularly perhaps in the Western world. And at least for the purposes of this lecture, I include New Zealand in the Western world. Political changes have taken place, economic changes have taken place, there have been social changes, cultural changes, and also great technological changes. We might even go so far as to say that in the course of the last few years, in the course of the last few decades, more changes, perhaps, have taken place in the world, and in the Western world in particular, than during any other comparable period of human history. This isn't necessarily a very surprising thing. Change, we know, is characteristic of all mundane things, of all mundane affairs. But so far as human affairs at least are concerned, in the course of the last decade or so, we've seen a constantly accelerating rate of change. So that we may even say that more and more changes seem to be taking place within shorter and ever shorter periods of time. Formerly, when the pace of things was slower, when you had, as it were, time to grow up, several generations might elapse before a particular change in some particular department of life started becoming noticeable. But that is no longer the case. Now, these changes are noticeable in the course of a single lifetime, even in the space of a single decade, even, in some cases, half a decade. And we see this constantly accelerating rate of change in practically all fields of human life and human endeavor, whether the political, economic, social, cultural, and so on. But tonight we're concerned with just one of those fields, a field which I shall call, just to use a good neutral general term, the cultural field. And in this particular field, the cultural field, one of the biggest, one of the greatest, and also potentially one of the most important changes that has taken place in recent years is with regard to this subject of meditation. Even 10-15 years ago, meditation was hardly heard of in the West. Whatever knowledge, whatever interest there was, as far as meditation was concerned, was confined, for the most part, to obscure groups and eccentric individuals. But now one may say that this word, this term, meditation, is almost a household word. But though the word is so current, I won't say well known, though the word is so current, this does not mean that what the word represents, what meditation means, is at all well understood. Those of you who were here last week may remember that we saw that there were quite a few misunderstandings about the nature of the Buddha, the meaning of the word Buddha, the enlightened one, and also misunderstandings about the nature of Buddhism, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha. And perhaps we can say that there are even more misunderstandings on the subject of meditation. So many times I've heard from people, meditation means making the mind a blank, making the mind empty. And others seem to think that meditation means simply sitting and doing nothing. Or sitting and doing nothing may be a very fine thing to do or not to do, but it isn't meditation. And again, sometimes you hear people say, or even you read, that meditation means sitting and gazing at your navel, possibly squinting as you do so. Or going into some kind of trance. Unfortunately, one very well-known and even very good writer on Buddhism has popularized to some extent this word trance as a synonym for meditation, most unfortunately. And other people again think that meditation means just sitting quietly and thinking about things, turning things over in one's mind. And others again think that meditation means a sort of self-induced hypnotic state. So these are just a few of some of the more popular, some of the more widespread misunderstandings about meditation. And the reasons for these misunderstandings, the reason why there should be misunderstandings at all, seems fairly obvious. For instance, meditation in the West is comparatively new. At least it's new in the modern West. There hasn't been, at least recently, anything quite like it within the range of our experience. And we don't have even the proper words, the proper terms with which to describe meditation, meditation states, with which to discuss meditation processes, and so on. So that it's only natural, this being a very new and unfamiliar subject, something which formerly wasn't within the range of our experience, it's only natural that there should be, at first, some misunderstanding. Then again, one must remember that meditation is essentially something to be practiced, something which one does, something which eventually one experiences, which one comes to experience. But most people still know about meditation only from hearsay. They don't know about it as a result of their personal practice and personal experience. They rely, therefore, on second-hand, third-hand, even fourth-hand information. And some even rely, have to rely, perhaps necessarily, for their information about meditation on books. Nowadays there are quite a few books on the market dealing or purporting to deal with meditation. But unfortunately these books themselves are only too often based on hearsay rather than on personal knowledge and personal experience. And in some cases they may even be based on pure imagination, not to say speculation. And again we see that now in this field there are quite a number of self-appointed experts. Because when something becomes popular, and when meditation becomes popular, only too many people are ready, as it were, to cash in on the boom. I remember in this connection my experience in India in the course of what was called the Buddha Jayanti year. That is to say, the year in the course of which was celebrated the 2500th anniversary of the Parinirvana, that is to say the passing away of the Buddha. 2500 years of Buddhism. So the government of India decided to sponsor the celebrations in India. Buddhist governments in different parts of Southeast Asia decided to sponsor the celebrations in their countries. There was a great output of books and articles, pamphlets and so on the subject of Buddhism. A great deal of interest was aroused, so there was, of course, a great demand for books and articles and pamphlets on Buddhism. So what did one see? One saw all sorts of people setting to work, writing books, pamphlets and articles on Buddhism, in many cases without the slightest qualifications at all, just getting together material from here and there, sometimes from reliable sources, sometimes from unreliable, and producing another work on Buddhism. And I remember on several occasions I had the experience of picking up one of these new works. Sometimes they used to come to me for review, and after reading a few pages I think, that seems familiar. Where have I read this before? And then I realized, oh yes, this is taken from one of my own books. But no quotation marks, no acknowledgements, and then immediately after the page or two pages from my book, there'd be another page or two or three pages from some rather different source. So quite clearly, various people were cashing in on the boom, and people were getting published books on Buddhism, which perhaps would not have been published at any other time under any other circumstances. So we see that something like this is happening in the West today. There's a sort of boom on in spiritual things in general, at least a modest, a minor boom, and also in meditation. We find that quite a number of people are dissatisfied with their ordinary everyday existence, that their ordinary everyday lives, their conventional way of living and doing things. We find that people can't accept a purely scientific explanation of life, despite the great practical success of science nowadays, and still, nevertheless, they find themselves unable to accept the traditional religious, that is to say mostly the Christian or Jewish, explanation of things either. So what happens? We find them looking for something else, looking around for something else which will satisfy them more deeply, more permanently, more creatively, and more constructively. And some people look, we know, in the direction of the Eastern religions, philosophies, spiritual traditions, and especially they look in the direction of meditation. They want to know about meditation. They want to practice meditation. Want to go along perhaps to meditation classes, attend meditation weekends, and in this way a sort of demand, as it were, for meditation is created. And only too many people are ready to supply that demand, in some cases, for a consideration. And some of these people may be quite well qualified to do so, to meet this demand, to teach meditation, and others may not. So in this way too, all sorts of misunderstandings arise. And again one finds that quite often meditation is identified with a particular kind of meditation, with a particular kind of technique. It isn't perhaps generally understood that there are many kinds of meditation, many ways of meditating, that is, many methods, many techniques. But sometimes people just know about one, or they practice one, or they stick to one, and then they identify the practice of meditation exclusively with having recourse to this particular technique. And sometimes they claim that this method is the best one, or this method is the only one, and that you're not actually meditating at all unless you meditate in this particular way, using this particular technique. The other techniques, the other practices, other traditions are, as it were, no value. So one gets this sort of misunderstanding, this sort of confusion arising. And it becomes, therefore, all the more important to clear up this confusion, to resolve these misunderstandings. It becomes important to understand, initially to inquire, what meditation really is. So in order to do this, in order to understand what meditation really is, we shall have to go back for a while to last week's lecture, back to that gap that we noticed between the ideal and the real, back to the gap between the enlightened man, or Buddha, and the unenlightened man, the ordinary man. In fact, we should also have to go back to our definition of Buddhism itself.